Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo, serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
It just needs to happen, because I don't want any other mothers to get a phone call from the school saying, where is your daughter today? And then having to go searching for them and finding them hanging from a tree.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, your hostess and the voice for patient safety. If you've been here before, you know that I like to go places where mainstream media stops. So with that, you just heard a snippet from today's guest, a normal mom from Chadlington, England, whose teenage daughter had such an ill response to wireless devices that she found no way out other than to do the unthinkable by taking her own life. Now, this child could have been saved had the school paid attention to the frequent pleas from the mother to allow her child a place, a space, within the school walls where she could think and work without being bombarded by the damaging frequencies given off by the wireless routers in the school. And you'll hear more about this health hazard later in the show. So meantime, let's get to business, because as usual, I have lots to share with you today. So let's get going, because right now, it's time for the healthcare hazard of the week. Are patient satisfaction surveys killing us? Oh, according to a recent article in the Washington Examiner titled, Obamacare Program May Be Linked to Emergency Room Opioid Prescriptions. Now, opioids, weird sounding word, but they are medications that relieve pain. You'll know the names of some of these. Medications that fall within this class include hydrocodone, called Vicodin, oxycodone, such as Oxycontin and Percocet, morphine, codeine, and other related drugs. Experts say too many patients are being prescribed opioid painkillers by emergency room doctors, and a program created by Obamacare could be enabling the problem. A new study released just last week found that 17% of nearly 20,000 patients were discharged from emergency rooms with an opioid prescription. Experts and lawmakers say a push under Obamacare for hospitals to get good patient satisfaction scores is one of the problems. America is in the midst of an opioid epidemic, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Painkillers killed more than 16,000 people in 2013. A huge part of the problem is the prescribing of painkillers, which quadrupled from 1999 to 2013, and emergency room prescriptions are part of this trend. For instance, opioid addicts will sometimes injure themselves just to get access to a small amount of painkillers, and it can be hard to tell whether the patient is actually hurt or an opioid addict. A patient could get 90 Oxycontins from a primary doctor and arrive in the emergency room asking for painkillers a few days later. Patients with back pain got the most opioids, followed by those with abdominal pain. Oxycodone, the active ingredient in Oxycontin, was the most prescribed with 52%. Doctors may feel pressured by hospital administrators to prescribe opioids because it may lead to a better score on a patient satisfaction survey. Program created by Obamacare tied extra funding to high scores on the survey because their reimbursement and quality ratings are linked to the way patients rate them on the categories, including a category about pain. Several senators wrote to CMS last year saying that the surveys could impact opioid prescribing, and they cited reports of doctors in South Carolina admitting to prescribing more opioids in a response to patient survey scores. One hospital with low satisfaction scores even went so far as to offer Vicodin goodie bags to patients discharged from its emergency room in an effort to improve its scores. Because there is a push to give the patient what they want, which may not always be the standard of care. And apparently, yes, many people want opioids. In fact, and get this, America consumes 80% of the world opioid supply. And that's 99% of the world hydrocodone supply, but only has 5% of the world's population. Now, if you don't think America has some kind of an opioid problem, well, gotta think again. Now, you combine this with the fact that in almost every single health plan in the United States, it's easier to get an MRI and back surgery than it is to get physical therapy. So there's a fine equation for you. More tests and stronger drugs equal more satisfied patients, and more satisfied patients equal, you got it, more pay. From an article titled, Why Rating Your Doctor is Bad for Your Health, in Forbes, they say, by creating a monetary incentive to increase patient satisfaction, the government is not only increasing its expenses, but promoting a metric that significantly increases death rates, says William P. Sullivan, an emergency room doctor in Spring Valley, Illinois. Another emergency room doctor in Columbia, South Carolina, who requested that we withhold his name, walked us through how this plays out in real life. Between 5% and 7% of his compensation, some $10,000, is dependent on high Press-Ganey scores. Now, Press-Ganey is the organization which administers the federal survey. So, when the family of an elderly woman insisted that she be admitted to the hospital after stroke-like symptoms, this doctor agreed to do so, even though her test results were negative and he wanted to send her home. The family refused, and they told me so, he recalls. Do I call security and escort them out? I was more concerned with them giving me a bad patient satisfaction survey score than her going home and having a stroke, which he considered highly unlikely. In admitting the patient, he exposed her to hospital-borne infections, and worse, a hefty bill, for as he puts it, us doing nothing since she did not satisfy the criteria for admission. Wow. Now, overtreatment is more than a silent killer. The article continues, it's cripplingly, interesting word, cripplingly expensive. Drill down to almost any procedure that keeps skittish patients happy, and the price tag is enormous. Overused prostate cancer screenings? At least $3 billion a year. Unnecessary antibiotics? Another $1 billion annually, with the added harm of creating drug-resistant bacteria. All told, overtreatment accounted for up to $226 billion in 2011 for things like unnecessary procedures, and prescriptions that don't help patients. Another $55 billion a year is directly tied to the abuse of prescribed opiates. Kind of ironic, since government-mandated surveys were supposed to cut medical costs. Well, until the government got involved, surveying patients was a sleepy niche business. Then, in 2002, the Centers for Medicaid Services announced a national program to survey patients and require public reporting of the results. The move was part of a Bush administration initiative to improve accountability and public disclosure, and to empower patients to make more informed decisions about health care. Well, now, let's not even think about how inaccurate those survey results are, as most surveys are flawed by the fundamental principles of statistics. Plus, what does patient satisfaction have to do with good medical care? Perhaps what the patient wants is not good medicine. Response rates to these surveys have been dramatically declining over the past decade, says Paul Alexander Clark, founder of Smart Patient, a healthcare analytics company. And he should know, because up until 2007, Clark was in charge of Press-Ganey's Patient Satisfaction Improvement Group. The response rates, he says, are now too low to produce reliable results. Insiders have known this for a decade. This is a dirty little secret in our industry, a senior Gallup executive wrote in a 2002 letter to the CMS chief. At those levels, the standard rules of probability don't exist. This means you may or may not be tracking real patient attitudes. Well, the Centers for Medicare Services declined several requests to comment on the record. Yet, Press Ganey says response rates are high enough to provide scientifically valid results. Well, I guess they would say this, since this is how they are getting paid. So what's the answer? Well, how about if all of us, both patients and providers, behave like responsible, respectable human beings? Doctors, take the time necessary to really evaluate the patient. Look at them in the eyes when you speak. Take care of each person as if it were your most beloved mother, dad, wife, husband, or child. Forget about the money. When you do the right thing for people, the money will follow. And as patients, let's become educated and not take the first pill thrown at us as we walk out the door, having no clue what we are about to ingest. And how about seeking safer alternative healing modalities and not run to the ER every moment begging for drugs? As my dad used to say when someone would call the house on the phone during dinner and it was the wrong number, wipe your eyes and dial again. In other words, let's wipe our eyes and get out of this foggy area of pretending that we're concerned about the patient by asking survey questions that really don't answer anything, but rather line the pockets of big medicine while drugging society and feeding big pharmaceutical. And dial again, and this time getting the correct number. And that is simply caring for another human being, another life, with no ulterior purpose, as in the Hippocratic corpus. I will follow that system of regimen which, according to my ability and judgment, I consider for the benefit of my patients, and abstain from whatever is deleterious and mischievous. I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor suggest any such counsel. Why does the government think they have the answer to this? Why is a physician or a hospital's pay reliant on how happily the patient answers a question after the fact? Let doctors do the job they signed on for. Let them faithfully follow the oath. I say, if the powers that be are more concerned with unreliable answers to a bunch of survey questions, to a mess of statistical foolishness, then get another job and get out of the way. Speak Up and Stay Alive, 5 simple words that address a complex problem, and that is your safety when it comes to every healthcare or hospital encounter, or the safety of your family and friends. These words need to be in your mind and on your lips. And to help with that, I wrote the book Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Hospital Survival Guide, on the recommended reading list of the U.S. Army's Medical Department Office of Quality Management. And it should be on your reading list too. Get a copy for yourself. Give some away as important gifts. Bring the book to the hospital with you. Lay it on the tray table. Now, without saying a word, everyone knows that you are an e-patient, equipped, and eager to get out unharmed. You can purchase online for only $19.95 at the website speakupandstayalive.com or call me and order by phone 440-725-5462. That's speakupandstayalive.com or 440-725-5462. Speak Up and Stay Alive. The book tells you how, and I hope you do. You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety. Well, today we have a story with a tragic ending about a young girl, age 15, Jenny Fry from Chadlington, England, who suffered from an acute case of electromagnetic hypersensitivity syndrome exacerbated by the Wi-Fi in her school's classrooms. Now, despite the fact that Jenny's mom, Deborah, pleaded with her daughter's teachers to allow her to work in rooms without Wi-Fi, the school refused. And then sadly, Jenny's recourse was to take her own life back in June 2015. Well, following her death, Jenny's family is now campaigning to raise awareness of EHS and how wireless technology can impact health. And right now, we have Jenny's mother with us, Deborah Fry, to fill in the blanks and share her efforts so this doesn't happen to anyone else. Welcome to the show, Deborah.
Hello.
Thank you for taking the time to share this story with us. And so if you would, maybe let's step back and kind of retell the story. When did Jenny first realize she was having symptoms? What was she feeling? And what was the first indication as to the fact that perhaps it was the Wi-Fi in the classroom that was initiating the problem?
To begin with, the very first symptoms I noticed, because unfortunately we did have Wi-Fi for a short time at home as well. And that was what alerted me that it was Wi-Fi, because when I took the Wi-Fi out of our house, her symptoms dramatically improved. So then my mission was, because they hadn't all gone away, was to alert the school and try to get them to relook at whether it was actually safe to have Wi-Fi in school for all the children's sake, but also because I was convinced by then that it had caused my daughter to have an awful lot of detentions which weren't justified, because she would wait, get her work at the beginning of the lesson, and then she would walk out of the classroom because they used to have seating plans and would be assigned a seat. And obviously in some of the classrooms, she must have been too close to the Wi-Fi router. And she would come home describing things like, well, I couldn't stay in there because I couldn't think straight. I needed to find somewhere where I could concentrate and get on with my work. So in walking out of the classroom, she would incur detention. Unfortunately, that got into a really big mess with the school. I think one year she had about 30 detentions. At that stage, she was managing to cope with the hassle with the teachers and the detentions. But as time wore on, it began to get her down. I did go into the school on numerous occasions, but unfortunately didn't manage to persuade them that this stuff really should never have gone into any school. I started campaigning really from that time on. So the first symptoms I noticed were in sort of January 2013, and we removed our Wi-Fi in about sort of September, October of 2013. And then from that moment on, I became aware of the Wi-Fi in the school because I had no idea it had Wi-Fi in it. I became aware around June 2013, which was when I first raised the issue with the school. After that, it's just been a case of trying to inform them with as much evidence as possible, as and when I got it, that this stuff shouldn't be around children. She was, you know, a great student with a great report. The problem started sort of from January 2013 onwards, and it built up to quite a crescendo by the sort of June of that year. And that was, if I go through the symptoms, first of all, within a month of us having Wi-Fi, and I now know with hindsight that the school actually put their big Wi-Fi system in at the same time as us. So it was over the half-term holiday that they put theirs in, and we put ours in. And within a month, we noticed just a very slight behaviour change, that she became a bit obsessed about time and washing her hair on a Sunday evening at exactly the same time. Even if we were at friends or relatives, she'd say, well, it's time for me to wash my hair. And that was just a really sort of strange behaviour. Then after that, the physical symptoms started to come thick and fast, and that was that she was unable to sleep properly. So we changed her mattress. I also changed the curtains for lined curtains because I thought the light might be bothering her. We changed all kinds of things, but nothing made any difference until we switched our Wi-Fi off. How that came to be is that she started to get more and more symptoms. So I was looking, well, what else has changed in her life? The biggest symptoms that were coming were ear noises, strange sensations in her head, head pains, headaches, sort of gluggy sensations in her ears. She got some itchy rashes. She got aches and pains in her joints. Then she had a really bad nosebleed and came down the stairs. She'd been working on her computer, the Wi-Fi laptop computer on her desk. And she came down the stairs unable to stop a really bad nosebleed. And the first thing she said to me was, I haven't picked my nose and I haven't knocked it. Why have I suddenly got this horrific nosebleed and I just can't stop it? Can you help me? And even I had a job to stop it. I had to pack it very carefully to get it to stop. And that made me check out on the internet nosebleeds and Wi-Fi. And I became alarmed and shocked and horrified at what I was finding. And I continued researching. I'd gone into the back garden a couple of days later. It was a lovely sunny day. And I'd said to my other half, wow, this is amazing technology. It's coming through three brick walls. Oh my God, just like x-rays. And that was when the penny dropped fully. And I said, right, we have to get this Wi-Fi out of the house. And it's got to be all hardwired to the Ethernet. And that's what happened at home. And immediately she started to be able to sleep. She didn't get any more nosebleeds. And she was feeling a lot better. But her problems of being able to concentrate at school continued. So that was why I was busy campaigning to try to get them to either find her somewhere to work at school. By this time, she was becoming aware herself that this was affecting her schoolwork. In the beginning, she didn't want to know. She wanted a mobile phone like everybody else, but because I absolutely knew mobile phones were hazardous to health, I wouldn't let her have one. Over here, back in 2007, we had Sir William Stewart, who recommended that he wouldn't give his children or grandchildren mobile phones until they were fully physically developed. And he said at the very least, the earliest he would give a child a mobile phone is 16. So she never used a mobile phone. She had borrowed one from a friend because she was going on a camping trip with the school. But, you know, we could probably count on fingers and toes the amount of time she actually ever used a mobile phone. She had a very tiny bit of exposure at grandparents' houses to decked phones. But the most shocking thing to me is how much damage can be done to a child from just Wi-Fi at school. And I think that's what the world needs to wake up to rapidly, because otherwise, unfortunately, we're going to have more and more tragedies as the tsunami of this technology has gone into our lives and it's everywhere. Very soon, unfortunately, there will be other children suffering the same fate unless all the world's governments wake up and rethink whether this really is a good idea to have this technology in with our children.
And Deborah, what was the response of the school officials when you brought that up to them? Did they listen? Did they discount you? How did that play out?
Well, the very first time I went into the head teacher, he did listen. He did take it quite seriously. But he said, well, the problem is for as many of the studies that you pointed out to me, I could find as many to say that it was safe. But he said, I will double check everything. Obviously, if I find anything's changed, then I will consider, you know, turning it off. But he said, I can't switch it off for one child. And I'd said, well, you wouldn't be switching it off for one child. It would be all the children, because exactly, this is affecting all the children. It's just that some show the symptoms far more quickly than others. But it isn't good for any children to be exposed to this. So we sort of went away, and then the summer holidays came, and I continued researching. And so every time, at sort of every 6 months or so, I would go back in with more information and pass it to him until pretty much just before Jenny died in the sort of March, I decided to start challenging the school again, because by this time I was 100% convinced that this stuff needed to be got out of the school as urgently as possible. And the problem was, a lot of people have said in some of the newspaper articles, well, why didn't the mum keep her child at school, at home? It's just very difficult when you've got a teenager who's in the middle of their examination years, in their crucial exams, to suddenly withdraw them from a system that they're sort of entrenched in. I mean, I did have that discussion with Jenny, but she didn't want to suddenly do online learning. She wanted to finish her education at school, so I had no alternative but to try to get it out of the school. Unfortunately, I didn't achieve that in time. I don't think on the day that she meant to actually go through with it, I think that she'd set herself up to try to bring in the police and to get a big investigation going and to highlight it in a big way. And I think everything just went dramatically wrong on the day. Obviously, I have lots of if onlys, and I will be going through those for the rest of my life. But at this moment, I'm just busy trying to raise as much awareness with as many scientific forums and medical forums and dental forums as possible, to just try to get the population of medical doctors, dentists, anybody who understands the science to come on board and try to protect children before it's too late.
Well, bless you for your efforts. Well, we appreciate all of the sharing of this story and all of the work that you're doing. Any last bits of advice or anything that you'd want to kind of wrap up with to entice our listeners to pay attention?
I think probably the final thing was that basically children are in the microwave oven. You know, unfortunately, in our wisdom, we've created this amazing world microwave oven. And but really, it is to look at everything, to watch your children's behaviour, their moods, look at the symptoms, look at the internet, look at the EHS symptoms, and think about it. So perhaps you have to home educate your children, or get together as a group of mums and work something out if we can't get it out of schools. I mean, certainly I had no idea that this was such a dangerous technology. When I first started campaigning at the school, I thought I was trying to save her from future cancer and fertility problems. I had no idea that there was this massive suicide risk with phone masts and Wi-Fi around schools, with the Wi-Fi in the schools and the phone masts around the schools. And obviously, you have to look at the 24/7 exposure. You have to look at where you live, what you've got in the house, what's in the school, what's by the school, where you go on holiday. We are all going to have to use the power of our feet by not booking with hotels that have Wi-Fi, but say, well, I've got children, I don't want to expose my children to Wi-Fi in a hotel. So there's so many ways we can start changing this. My daughter's words are, I have no hope for humanity. We're destroying this beautiful earth as we speak. And those were her sort of final words. So I would urge everybody to think about this big mistake we've made and try to reverse it as quickly as possible for the sake of the children. It just needs to happen, because I don't want any other mothers to get a phone call from the school saying, where is your daughter today? And then having to go searching for them and finding them hanging from a tree.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much for sharing this heart-wrenching story with us. And I certainly hope that everyone listening will take heed. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing to help others avoid this horrible tragedy. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm here with disturbing news about our favorite gadgets, cell phones, tablets, Wi-Fi, etc. Putting it bluntly, they are damaging the living cells in our bodies and killing many of us prematurely. I'm Dr. Martin Blank from the Department of Physiology and Cellular Biophysics at Columbia University. Before Edison's light bulb, there was very little electromagnetic radiation in our environment. The levels today are very many times higher than natural background levels and are growing rapidly because of all the new devices that emit this radiation. An example that a lot of us have in our pockets right now is the cell phone. One study shows that as cell phone usage has spread widely, the incidence of fatal brain cancer in younger people has more than tripled. We are putting cellular antennas on residential buildings and on top of hospitals where people are trying to get well. Wireless utility meters and cell towers are blanketing our neighborhoods with radiation. Future generations, our children, are at risk. The World Health Organization and international standard-setting bodies are not acting to protect the public's health and well-being. We are really all part of a large biological experiment without our informed consent. To protect our children, ourselves, and our ecosystem, we must reduce exposure by establishing more protective guidelines.
As you just heard from quite the expert, Dr. Martin Blank, a previous guest on this show, the radio frequencies emitted from cell phones, baby monitors, cordless phones, smart meters are known to cause health problems. Therefore, I suggest you do everything you can to avoid any prolonged contact with any device that emits this type of microwave radiation. Because radio frequencies are invisible, you must own a detection meter to measure the levels of radiation emitted not only from your or your neighbor's smart meter, but also from cell towers in your neighborhood, stealth cell antennas hidden within flagpoles, in church steeples, gas station signs, wireless in libraries, stores, coffee shops, hotels, hospitals, and from cell phones and secondhand phone. I firmly believe that everyone should own a small handheld meter that can detect these dangerous frequencies. So with that, I've done the research for you and now offer EMF meters, RF meters, and other detection, measurement, and shielding devices through a company called Safe Living Technologies. They have an extensive selection of useful items that range from entry level to professional level, and I personally own what I'm asking you to own. You can find them at our website, speakupandstayalive.com, speakupandstayalive.com, and go to the link that says Stop Smart Meters. There you will see a picture of a reasonably priced meter. I think it's about $140 or less, and there's no tax. Plus, I offer a free gift with every purchase, a free copy of my book, and a free patient experience CD. You simply cannot prevent that which you don't measure. So here's a way to basically make the invisible visible. Just like your body, your organs, and ultimately your health cannot survive in a smoke-filled room, neither can you survive in an environment filled with electrosmog. So get yourself a meter. Buy them as gifts. They are soon to become a mainstream necessity in order to survive in this world filled with unprecedented levels of life-diminishing man-made frequencies. Go to speakupandstayalive.com and visit the Stop Smart Meter page. I wouldn't waste your time or mine talking about this if it was not important to your health and your future.
In your face, all over the place. We're online 24/7. 24/7. You're listening to the hottest.
SpeakUpAndStayAlive.com. That's SpeakUpAndStayAlive.com.
You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio. Listen to us live online from anywhere in the world at the station's websites. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. So happy to spend this hour with you to help you survive any healthcare or hospital encounter.
It's time for our favorite program, right?
What's that?
Fear the Wheelchair.
Oh my gosh, Joe's always so excited to play. By now you've heard me talk about how I fear the wheelchairs that grace the front doors of almost every hospital. Patients and visitors get out of their cars and hop into the wheelchair, and I always wonder, where have they been? What have they touched? Then they wheel around the hospital and use the bathroom, sit in waiting rooms, visit patients, all the while picking up additional and deadly hospital bacteria like MRSA, C. diff, a bit of E. coli, and perhaps some candida yeast. And And at the end of the day, they're back in their car, leaving the contaminated wheelchair at the front door of the hospital, ready for the next patient to climb aboard. This makes the wheelchair a high-touch, highly contaminated vehicle capable of spreading infections all over the place. So the wheelchair is now this show's representation of all hospital dangers, kind of like our mascot. So here we go with our new favorite. Well, it's not new anymore, but it's our favorite game.
Yes, it is.
It is. And what is it, Joe?
Fear the wheelchair.
Well, let's listen as Joe reads some right or wrong statements. And then even though I can't hear you, shout out your answer along with Bob. Is the statement right or is it wrong? All right, Joe.
All right, here we go. Right or wrong. Here's a restroomology question. Bathroom stalls on the right side are cleaner than the stalls located on the left.
What do you think about that, Bob?
I think about it. Maybe it's right.
Oh, no. That is wrong. Bob, most people are right-handed and tend to gravitate to the right-handed stalls. So if you enter a restroom and that has stalls on the left and the right, which one are you going to choose?
Left.
Yes, that's important stuff, Bob.
Right or wrong, if you're going to the hospital for any type of surgery, ask to be tested for MRSA.
What do you think, Bobby?
That is definitely right.
Yes, that is right. Anyone who is considered an at-risk patient should request a nasal MRSA screening.
Right or wrong, when researching symptoms on the internet, believe everything you read. If it's in writing, then it must be true.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, that's wrong.
Yes, that's obviously wrong. But you know what? You'd be surprised how many folks tend to think that way. Research several different sites. Check to see who's funding the site. Make sure they're simply not in the business to sell wonder drugs or overnight cures. The bottom line, be a detective. Uncover every source that you can. Compare and check with your healthcare provider.
All right, right or wrong, if you don't see any bleach wipes in your hospital room, just dust your bed tray with a napkin or paper towel.
Oh, what do you think, Bob?
That's definitely wrong.
Of course that's wrong. Ask the hospital staff for a canister of bleach wipes, put on a pair of gloves, and clean every high-touch item in your room using one bleach wipe per surface. I do this several times each day just as a precaution.
Right or wrong, 40% of tray tables on the airplanes are contaminated with MRSA.
What do you think, Bob?
That's a little high. Maybe that's wrong.
Sadly, that statement is right. Here's what I do whenever I fly. I bring a baggie of bleach wipes and I wipe down the seat and the seat belt and the tray tapes. With turnaround times as fast as they are, nothing is cleaned, let alone sanitized. And what's interesting is the person sitting next to me or across from me always asks to borrow some of my wipes.
Oh, bring hand sanitizer.
You think I should bring that as well? Do you remember that time that, I guess the cabin pressurized my bottle of hand sanitizer, and when I opened the lid, the gel squirted all over the pants on the guy next to me.
It was sort of embarrassing.
It was crazy. Any more, Joe?
Yeah, this last one. Right or wrong, only wealthy people should pursue any kind of estate planning.
How about that, Bob?
Oh, that's wrong.
Yes, that is very wrong. And I challenge everyone listening today to get their financial and healthcare affairs in order. Power of attorney, living wills, last wills and testaments. You'll be glad you did. Well, remember, the more you know, the safer you'll be. And you heard about it here on Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Well, thanks, guys, once again for playing everybody's favorite game.
Fear the wheelchair.
You are listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. I am Pat Rulo, where the boys and I are keeping you safe during any healthcare or hospital encounters. Does your doctor shake your hand when he or she enters your exam or hospital room? Ooh, where has that hand been? Did you know that healthcare-acquired infections are one of the leading causes of death? Well, now you do, and you'll learn more when you join me, Pat Rulo, and listen to Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio every Saturday morning. For more information, visit speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com. Are you a patient? Or are you a population? Lately, I've been hearing a lot of talk about patients and populations. It seems that with all eyes on the rising cost of healthcare, the focus is shifting from what is best for the individual patient to what is best for the entire population. That's an interesting thought, right? And I'm betting that there are some shouting out for both sides. The question is it the way to go? The American Medical Association recently defined population-based medicine as an approach quote, that allows one to assess the health status and health needs of a target population, implement and evaluate interventions that are designed to improve the health of that population, and efficiently and effectively provide care for members of that population in a way that's consistent with the community's cultural, policy, and health resource values, unquote. One of the easiest ways to illustrate this is to think about medication prices. Your doctor is supposed to prescribe the very best treatment for you. He or she is looking out for your best interest as the patient, regardless of the price of the medication. But if your doctor is looking out for the population, his or her thought process might consider prescribing a less expensive drug to save the resources for other patients. In fact, some believe that doctors, as part of their Hippocratic oath to do no harm, includes doing no harm economically. Therefore, they must consider the financial side of treating a patient as well as the medical side. And I wonder, is that the true original intent of the Hippocratic oath? Now, a lot of this is candy-coated with happy words, just like smart meters, smart appliances that attempt to blind you with false impressions. If it says smart, it must be. Well, there's a new campaign called Choosing Wisely. The American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation is encouraging doctors to implement the new health law by encouraging them not to diagnose patients too often and to cut down on unnecessary medical tests. The website states, Choosing Wisely is working to spark conversations between providers and patients to ensure the right care is delivered at the right time. And yes, I can certainly agree with that statement. The campaign lists 45 tests to avoid from 9 different medical groups. Each recommendation begins with the words, don't have this test done if, don't perform this, don't prescribe that, do not do this, do not do that. And while I am the first to say that we should be concerned with unnecessary testing, procedures, and medications, for anyone to stand up and say that in every instance we should consider ruling out any test prior to even seeing a patient is simply not good medicine. Despite the smart words, choosing wisely, it's not really about patients, although on the surface it appears that way. It is a political promotion designed to use doctors as a way to affect the bottom line for the population, not the individual patient. Now, does anyone other than me see the obvious conflict when we ask our doctors to take care of both the health side of the patient and the financial side of the population? Now, don't get me wrong, I do understand the need to address the abuse of CAT scans and medical imaging, the wanton overprescribing of drugs, the needless medical procedures. In fact, many times that's what this program is all about. But on the other hand, and more importantly to me, I want my doctor to be all about me, what is in my best interest, not, oh gee, she's too old or too sick to deserve this medication or treatment. Better save it for the next guy who might be more deserving. I want my doctor to worry about me. And what right does a healthcare provider even have to be put in that position? Maybe we should ask a doctor, does he or she even want to think about this when diagnosing and treating a patient? I don't have the final answer, but I do know that we need to keep questioning. Should populations trump the individual patient? Well, back to the Choosing Wisely effort. I'm not sure that there are not political undertones that have nothing to do with a person's health, but I do like the name. Choosing Wisely. We as a society must pay attention to the politics of healthcare and choose wisely the direction we take. If you were to choose wisely, what do you say? Are you a patient or are you a population? Hey guys, I think that sounds like a new game. Patient or population? Is that a shock?
Wow!
Or is it a crock?
Oh!
Why choose the Welsh Home in Rocky River, Ohio to care for your loved one's senior care? Let's spend the next 2 minutes with Sarah Cook from the Welsh Home and find out. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sarah, what levels of care do you offer at the Welsh Home?
We have short-term rehabilitation stay. We do skilled nursing needs, again, on a short-term or a long-term basis. We have long-term health care for those that need permanent living situation. And we also do have a very small assisted living.
But you basically specialize in folks who need care right after a hospital stay. Is that correct?
Correct. The post-acute is what the industry is calling it right now. Care needs are those that when somebody's coming from the hospital and intending to go home, kind of a short stay to help set up that person for success, not only in our environment, but when they go home. It's that additional education, therapy, and just opportunities to make sure that the person is successful once they transition back to home.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know needs this transition period from hospital to home, you are invited to come in for a tour and see firsthand the quality of services the Welsh Home has to offer. And you do not have to be Welsh. Call them today to arrange for a tour. It's 440-331-0420. 440-331-0420, or you can visit online at welshhome.com. You are listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety. Quite a lot to digest today, and that's good, because there's so much going on in the health and healthcare world that we simply don't hear about it in the news. By the time we hear anything, it's been scrubbed and rubbed and scraped and sanitized. Who knows what's real and what isn't? It bothers me that we are only fed what we are supposed to know. So I salute you for listening to this program and taking that risk to find out the truth, even though at times it is ugly and painful. But knowledge is power, as they say, and that allows us at a grassroots level to speak up and speak out and make some positive changes. And if you want even more knowledge about healthcare safety, invite me to speak to your group, your club, business, church, or hospital. Obviously, there's so much to talk about, and I'm good at that. Your crowd will thank you because my presentations move. I'm quick, to the point, and offer a bushel full of tips and tools that you can use during every hospital or doctor visit. Call me to set a date, 440-725-5462. 440-725-5462. And visit the website for testimonials, pictures, and of course, to get a copy of the book that started it all. It's easy to read and covers over 17 different hospital hazards, many I'm sure you haven't thought of. Just visit speakupandstayalive.com. speakupandstayalive.com, all spelled out, or call me and order by phone, 440-725-5462. And speaking of books, lately I've been hearing and reading about the rampant overprescribing of opiate drugs, and recently I read an outstanding book called Free Refills, written by a Harvard physician who he himself spent years prescribing these kinds of drugs for his own use, and how that completely and utterly destroyed his career and his marriage. Well, I contacted him and asked if he would share his story with you and me on this radio program, and he agreed. His schedule is tight, so it won't be until the first show in March, so mark your calendars for that. I can't wait, and maybe, if you can't, get a copy of his book. It's called Free Refills, A Doctor Confronts His Addiction, by Dr. Peter Grinspoon. Dr. Peter Grinspoon. And I'm sure you can get that at Amazon.com. For me, it shed a light on the fact that drug addiction is not just a patient problem or a problem for crazies on the street, but that doctors are ripe for this kind of thing. So it promises to be an important conversation, and I hope you join me. Well, meantime, we are running out of time. So be sure to come back next week when our guest shares her journey with hepatitis C and how that seems to be on the rise, as well as the drug prices that can cure it. How's this? $1,000 per pill or $95,000 for a 12-week course of treatment? Oh, yeah, like anyone could afford that. Well, she'll be here to talk about it all, so come back. Same time, same place. But you know me, never the same information. Until then, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week, full of opportunities to speak up about what matters most to you. I am Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
I'm Jerry the Germ with a Speak Up and Stay Alive healthcare and hospital safety snippet just for you. Here's our expert, Pat Rulo.
Hey, Jerry, here's a quick one. Use enough liquid hand sanitizer to keep your hands wet for 15 seconds. That's how long it takes to get rid of Jerry's like you. For more tips like this, listen to Speak Up and Stay Alive every Saturday morning or visit speakupandstayalive.com. Brought to you in part by the Junction Auto Family. That's where I buy my cars, people you can trust for your next Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, Buick, GMC, and used cars. US 322 and Ohio 44 since 1931. Visit junctionautofamily.com. If you want to pay more, that's your business. If you want to pay less, that's Junction's business.
Listen to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Tune in every Saturday morning. For more information, go to speakupandstayalive.com.